Welcome to Heartland Darkland. I'm Cassie.
And I'm Shannon.
Welcome, Dark Hearts.
Hey, Dark Hearts.
You know, no one said yay or nay, so we're just going to continue with it and hope you guys don't absolutely hate it.
Yeah, and if you do hate it, just don't tell us. Just kidding. Maybe you should tell us.
I mean, yeah, tell us, but in a nice way.
Yeah, thank you.
And maybe have a suggestion of your own.
Yeah. That's what I figured. Oh, my watch just went off. Wow, I bumped it. Siri has a suggestion. I don't know if that's good or bad. So sorry about that.
Siri's always listening.
She's always got something to say. She's an annoying one.
You know. Did you want to give the update about our giveaway?
Yeah. So as you guys know, we have talked about that we would like to be in the top 200 in Apple Podcasts because we were briefly or shortly kind of, I don't know exactly. Yeah. So, and I mean, this can change on the daily. So what we kind of just decided to do, because we were running that contest for those of you who are just joining in or don't remember, if you left us a review and you rated us and then send us proof of that, we would enter you into a little contest that we're going to give away some of our, I don't know, our fun merch.
We're getting a tote
bag. Probably the tote bag. Is that for sure?
Yeah. Okay.
So then if you do that, you could be entered. But instead of being in the top 200, which of course we would love, we're thinking we're just going to run it through the end of June. So anybody who, if you rate and review us, just send us that and you'll automatically be entered. And then, I mean, at the end of June, July 1st, even we'll probably just figure out, we'll draw and let you know.
Yeah. I know that they're like randomizers, so we can like put everyone's names in and then we'll have something ticket.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe we'll figure out, I've seen other people like make videos of it so that people can see who was drawn. So it's like, there's no favoritism or anything like that.
Yeah. So we'll, I know how to do that.
We'll do it. Perfect.
I know how to do one thing, not a lot, but some things, that thing I do know. So yeah.
Perfect. I think this week, otherwise you guys, we're going to jump right in because I've got a kind of bigger, slightly heavier case this week. This is probably going to be a longer episode, which I know lately for me, I feel like I've been doing shorter episodes lately.
Oh yeah.
It's just
what even kind of working.
Yeah. It's kind of, I mean, it's been kind of working out that way. We always try to make it 45 minutes to an hour. This one's probably going to be an hour and a half or longer. Hopefully no more than 2 hours. I don't think it would hit 2 hours.
Okay. I'm like, well, we might have to put a pause on that if it's a 2 hour, but you know, we'll be good.
Oh crap. Yeah. It is already 1:45 when we're recording this. It's fine. We'll see. The thing is now, you guys, is fingers crossed and knock on wood.
Yes.
We're hopefully getting our recording figured out. We are recording remotely, but hopefully the sound quality this week will be better.
Yeah. We know it wasn't great last week. I had a lot of different feedback on that and I apologize, but we kind of did it to ourselves too, because it was a last minute thing due to schedules. And so we kind of just had to roll with it. So hopefully it's better already for you.
I mean, we really appreciate you guys hanging in there with us, but you guys also remember, like, we're brand, like, this is new. This isn't, we're not tech savvy people to begin with.
No.
This is nothing in either one of our fields. We're YouTubing and learning as we go. So we really appreciate all of the love and support. And you guys continuing to come back. So thank you guys.
Yeah, we love it.
But anyways, let's dive right in. So this week, I'm covering the Beatrice Six, which is one that I surprisingly, growing up in Nebraska my whole life, I didn't know about until about a year ago when an acquaintance of mine, he mentioned that his cousin was one of the Beatrice Six in this. And that's kind of how I learned. And for those of you who aren't aware, obviously we're going to dive in. But I'm kind of surprised that I didn't know, because some of the stuff that deals with this case was taking place. Like, this happened in 1985 is when it all started.
Okay.
I want to say. We'll come in there. But there were things still taking place in 2008 and 2009.
Yeah, so, I had not heard of it until you mentioned it to me. It sounded a little bit familiar, but not enough that I even knew what it was about. So I'm excited.
Right. I'm a little surprised. But like I said, an acquaintance of mine, and I'm not going to name names or anything like that. I didn't ask if I could talk to his cousin. I didn't try to reach out to any of these people. And I'll get into that again a little bit later, but this is to respect their privacy and their lives. And I'll kind of dive in a little bit more later as to why I went that route. Yeah, I mean, this took up so much of their lives, and I know I'm kind of getting ahead of myself, but yeah, so that, oh, I hit my computer. Hopefully you don't hear that.
I mean, it's fine. It happens. There's worse things.
So for my research, what I got it from was there's a documentary on the ID channel, Investigation Discovery. Can watch this on Discovery Plus. It's called The Beatrice Sixth, Keith Morrison Investigates, which it was about an hour and a half. And on Discovery Plus, there are commercials and stuff. But then there is also the book Failure of Justice, A Brutal Murder, An Obsessed Cop, Six Wrongful Convictions by John Ferrick. And if you can tell by how long that title is, it's definitely an indication of how long the book is. Yes. I tried to start reading it from like page one on. It's almost 500 pages. And I'm good with that. But he puts in so many details. And there are some that I just felt like it wasn't necessary. So I watched the documentary and then I'd go into the book to flesh parts out. But those are the things, you know, I'll link those. I'll mention those cool. in the details, whatever you call it, the summation of our episode.
Perfect.
I mean, there's a lot of articles you can kind of find on this one too. I didn't really look at a ton. I skimmed a few to kind of get, like, when I was typing out my notes to, like, look at details again that I maybe forgot and didn't want to try to go through the book for. But this is a murder case. Too. I know people were like, okay, what the hell are you talking about? For those who don't know what who the Beatrice Six are, what anything yeah, about it.
You That's know. What I'm wondering right now, you know.
Bear with me.
Where are you
me.
Going so, with this, Cassie?
I know. And you're gonna continue to wonder that for a little while. Just bear with me. And I am gonna talk about the victim and what happened to her because she is just as important and her family went through so much as well. And unfortunately, this is one of those cases that is full of victims, you know, it's a hard case. And so to start us off, I'm actually going to go to 1983. And this is actually about 18 months before the actual murder takes place. Again, bear with me.
All right.
Okay. So Beatrice, first of all, for those who don't know, is a town in Nebraska. It's about 44 miles south of Lincoln, and Lincoln's the state's capital. I found that it's the 10th largest state or largest city in the state, but it's like one of those little big towns. Like Omaha's a little big town, but this is even more of a little mm-hmm. big town. You know what I mean?
I know when you say 10th, I'm like, well, Nebraska, like that doesn't mean a lot to because Nebraska's full of small towns. So I'm like, 10 could really go either way.
I know, exactly. And so like they were probably around 10 to 12,000 in the mid 80s. I was trying to find like, population of 10 to 12,000 in the mid 80s. And I couldn't find an exact number, but it did show that in 1990 there were 12,395, and that was when the town was still growing, and I guess it's actually shrinking now.
Well, after whatever happened there.
Right, so the reason I mentioned this is because it's kind of important to give you a feel for the town and of its people. So, small town feel, Nebraska, where everyone kind of knows everybody and everyone's in everyone's business. You know, you still got some farmers on the outskirts, things like that.
Oh, yeah.
So, in June of 1983, there were four separate incidents of older women who lived alone having their homes broken into and a young white male attempting to sexually assault them. These all happened in a 6-week time frame and all within blocks of each other. But every time, the man was scared off by the women screaming or fighting back. So, like, none of them were ever,
like, successful with it?
Assaulted. Yeah.
Okay.
So, the final one happened in August of 83. And after that, nothing. And unfortunately, no one was able to ID the man. And after a while, with no other incidents, the police believed he was either a drifter or maybe in jail for other crimes. And that was that. And... yeah, so I know that sounds weird, but that's going to come into play again later.
Well, that's alarming in a small town anyway.
It is. So then,
wow.
The town was on high alert. Oh, you froze for a second.
Oh, there we are. Sorry, guys. Okay, so the town's on high alert because we have a guy breaking into homes. Okay.
Right. But then by February of 1985, it was just like a distant memory. You know, at this point, it's been a year and a half, so people just figure it's done with. Until the morning of Wednesday, February 6th of 1985, when Helen Wilson, a 68-year-old widow and grandmother, was found deceased in her apartment by her brother-in-law.
Oh.
Yeah. So before we get to the murder and the eventual convictions, I just want to talk about Helen Wilson a little bit and who she was, because I feel like it's a little easy for her to get lost in this story and just become the woman who was murdered. And clearly that's not who she was. And her family even states in the show that that's not how they want her remembered, which obviously she was a loving grandmother. So she had lived in Beatrice with her husband, Ray, and this is where they raised their three children. Unfortunately, Ray passed of a heart attack in the 1960s at the age of 54, but Helen stayed in Beatrice, as did two of her children. One son moved to Scotts Bluff, Nebraska.
Hey!
Which, that's episode where I'm from. One. But despite this distance, everyone was really close, and Helen would actually take the Greyhound bus at least twice a year to visit her son Larry and his family in Scotts Bluff. So everyone says that Helen was a cheerful person, always willing to help, that she loved to stay busy and do for others. One grandson mentioned that they called her Little Miss Sunshine because she was always smiling.
Oh.
Also, side note, I love that movie with Steve Carell.
Oh my gosh. I was just talking about it the other day to you. Do you remember when I was making a reference to Toni Collette being in that movie?
Yes.
Yeah, that's just weird that we just...
I love that movie. Okay, so, okay, also adorable factor, she would write poems for her family members as gifts.
Okay, that's really sweet.
Yeah, and she would then, like, she was always taking pictures every time they were together, like, she had a bunch of, like, photo books and stuff like that, but she would also, quote-unquote, secretly hide a tape recorder. Like, everyone knew she was doing this, like, she had a tape recorder, and she'd put a new tape in when everyone was together.
Yeah.
And she would record everyone being together because she liked to go back then and listen to it. Or she would send people little tapes of her playing she played the ukulele. And so, you know, she would just record herself.
That's really sweet.
Saying these poems, playing the ukuleles. And everyone says she absolutely adored being a grandmother. Like, she loved it so much. And she did live alone in a small apartment in downtown Beatrice. But none of her family was worried about it because it was Beatrice. The apartment was tiny, but she said she didn't need much. And her sister and brother-in-law actually lived right next door.
Oh, that's nice.
So the apartment building used to be the old Lincoln Electric Company, but it was converted into apartments. And, you know, like I said, her sister and brother-in-law lived next door, and they would often, like, make her a plate of whatever, you know, her sister had made for dinner.
Yeah.
And her other two children, Daryl and Jan, also lived in town, so they'd come in and check on her and stuff, too. So she wasn't alone by any means.
And had a big community, it sounded like. I mean, in her own village. Yeah.
Exactly, because she was a big part of, like, the church and helping people. And I think one of her grandkids in the documentary who was interviewed said she would clean people's houses, too. Mm-hmm. And, like, some people paid her, some didn't. You know, she just... She wanted to stay busy and she wanted to be helpful. So actually the night before Helen was found murdered, her son Daryl and his wife Katie had stopped by to check on her because she had just gotten home from a visit with her son Larry and his wife Edith. Mm-hmm. And while she was there, she like developed a really bad cold. So they tried to get her to go to the doctor there, but she was like, no, I'm going to see my own doctor. I'm going to go back home. And, Katie would later remark to police that normally Helen would have made a pot of coffee, but that night she apologized to them because she hadn't made one because she just didn't feel good. Mm-hmm. So that's going to come into play later. Make note. So Daryl and Katie left by 9:45, and then Katie promised to call Helen at midnight to make sure she took her next dose of meds.
That's cute. Okay, that's adorable, actually, that they're like calling her just a reminder to do that. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a side note, but that's sweet.
It sounds like they were a very close-knit family. I think that's adorable.
Yeah, that is cute.
So Katie tried to call at midnight, but Helen didn't answer. And figuring she was just sleeping heavily, she decided to try again in a little bit. But the next time she tried calling, the phone didn't ring at all. And later in the morning, residents would discover their power had gone out. And repeatedly in the book and the show, it's mentioned how this was like the coldest night in a long time. So I guess it just took a while for people's heat to like their apartments to cool off and stuff. So they didn't notice. And I think in the book, it mentions that they found that the power was cut, but then it kind of isn't brought up really again. Like,
because this was in February, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, in Nebraska in February, anyone who knows, it could either be like 60 and sunny, or it could be like negative 30. So I mean,
like, it was super, super cold. It was like one of the coldest nights in history at that time.
Jeez.
So at 9 a.m. on February 6th, Helen's sister Florence wanted to check on her sister since she knew she had a bad cold and she hadn't heard from her yet. And this is also where some differences come in. Like, in the book, it says Florence tried to knock and to call her sister with no answer, and she used a key to get in. But in the documentary, it talks about how there were scratches and signs showing the lock had been probably been slipped. Like, it says the door would have been easy to break into. So, I don't know. I don't really remember. And in the documentary, I don't remember Florence being mentioned going over. It just talks about her husband, Ivan, going over. But he was also known as Red. So, I mean, the documentary could have just left it out for the sake of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I'm going to kind of tell you both. So, the book describes Florence as walking over and, like, walking right by Helen's body and not noticing her. And also not noticing blood all over her bedroom.
How old was Florence?
I mean,
like, older? I mean,
I think she was maybe older, but I don't know why she was the one making dinner all the time then. Especially because, so it says that her eyesight was poor, but if she doesn't see these things, her eyesight's got to be more than poor.
Was she, like, blind, maybe?
Gosh. Listen, if I don't have my contacts in, I couldn't miss that stuff. And I'm at, like, negative 11.5 in both eyes.
Yeah.
So I am almost blind. So I don't exactly know. And then I wonder, too, I'm like, well, did Florence contaminate the crime scene? Did she walk through?
Right.
I don't know.
Because in the 80s, too, like, I mean,
yeah.
So different.
Yeah. So Helen, or not Helen, Florence then calls her husband Red to come over because she thinks something's wrong. Well, okay, so then it says she saw her sister laying in the living room floor and she thought she was asleep, but she thought something seemed wrong.
Yeah, on the floor, that's probably a good first red flag.
Yes. So I'm going to give trigger warning right now. There is mention of sexual assault in here, rape. Like, it gets a bit brutal. I'm not going to go into massive detail, but just mentioning stuff, you know, it's still...
Yeah.
So Red comes over and he immediately notices that Helen is nude from the waist down. She had a towel covering her face, and under the towel, there's a scarf wrapped around the entirety of her head. And her hands and feet have been bound with towels, and she's just stretched out across her living room floor. It'll later be determined that Helen died by suffocation, but she'd also been badly beaten and raped. So she had multiple broken bones, like broken ribs, broken wrist. I think her elbow was broken. There was blood all over her bedroom and living room. And there was a bloody washcloth in the bedroom sink. And there was also a steak knife from Helen's kitchen, and it was found near her bedroom door. So it's believed that the attacker grabbed it and used it to make Helen comply, but she was never stabbed.
Oh.
So, like, it was never actually used on her.
Okay, good. I mean, but still. Yeah.
And at the scene, police actually had a lot of DNA evidence. Helen appeared to have fought back, and the killer, again, he left quite a bit of semen. It's later, like, they believe she was raped both before her murder and after.
Nope. Gosh. Yeah. That's so terrible.
So they think she was raped many times.
Yeah.
And that's why, I mean, they talk about how there was a ton of semen left, and we'll kind of come back to that too.
Like, so it sounds like he didn't even try, yeah, to cover anything up. It's like, well, you wanted to get caught, but...
Well, but if you think about it, DNA wasn't a huge thing.
That's true, in the 80s, yeah.
Yep. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go on and how that stuff comes into play, too. Ugh. So, clearly, they ruled her death a homicide and thought she had been killed sometime between 10:30 a.m. and 2:30 a.m., but then, like, in the documentary, I think they said midnight to 2:30. I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, when they're that old, I feel like you get a lot of different variant times on.
Yeah.
So,
something else to note is that at the scene, like, when they were taking pictures, there was half a pot of coffee and several coffee cups in the sink.
But she didn't want to make coffee, right?
Yeah. And Katie insists that when they left, the kitchen was spotless.
And if she was sick, she would have went to bed then, so.
Right. And then another really important thing to note is that nothing was stolen. And Helen had over $1,200 in cash in her purse alone. And it was clearly visible. And then I think it said that there was like another few hundred in her dresser drawer.
Weird.
And so I Googled it. And that $1,200 in today's value is like, that's over $3,000 in today's money. So she just had that chilling in her purse.
So it seems like a super personal thing.
Right? And, was like very much, yeah. So I'm also like, when there was that much money there, I wonder if it's like some sort of Great Depression hangover, like she didn't believe in banks or trust banks, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then one final thing to note is there was half of a $5 bill on the floor. Like, a $5 bill had been ripped and it was just left on the floor.
Odd.
Yes. And then a few weeks after the murder, a man who worked at a gas station not far from the apartment reported seeing an unfamiliar young man early that morning. I think he said it was around like 6 a.m. He said he was in his 20s, white, skinny, shaggy hair, and a pockmarked face and looked generally unkempt. He said he noticed what appeared to be bloodstains on his clothes.
Hmm.
Why did we take weeks to report this? Also, he caught the dude trying to steal, like, he went up to pay for, like, a bag of Doritos, but then a couple more bags fell out of his coat, and the guy was like, are you gonna pay for those? And he's like, oh yeah, sorry. Like, you're not gonna call the cops on that? You think he's,
right.
You think he's got blood?
That's not sketchy at all.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
So then another man, Michael Hyatt, would eventually come forward to police to report who he believed could have done it. And I'm not exactly sure when he reported this. The book said after he read about the murder. The documentary just said he came forward.
Okay.
So he tells police he believes it could be an old friend of his named Bruce Allen Smith. Why does he think this? Well, let me tell you. Because the night before, he'd gotten into town. So he'd gotten to town on February 5th, 1985. They'd been hanging out at a local bar with some of Hyatt's other friends, two of whom were women. And while they're there, Smith mentions to Hyatt that it's been a long time since he's gotten any sex. He hasn't had sex.
And thank you for clarifying, Cassie.
I mean, you know, maybe
for those that don't know. Yeah, no, I know. It was funny. Just the way you said it was funny.
I know. So he says, and I quote, he told Hyatt, and I quote, I'm getting some ass tonight, one way or another.
Okay. First of all, gross, you're a loser. Second, if he did do that, ew.
Yeah,
that's just yeah, I know.
Yeah,
just the mind going.
Yeah,
okay.
So later they all go to the two women's trailer for an after party where Smith eventually tried to assault one of the women, and in the book the guy writes she became furious, and I was like, yeah, no shit,
you think?
Gosh. Shocker that a woman who rejected a man's advances would be mad when he tried to force them on her.
Yeah, seriously.
So that's where, like, that's how some of the writing in the book was, and I was just like, dude, okay.
Right.
So a fight ensues, and eventually, like, a man who lived next door kicks Smith out, and Hyatt and another of his friends decide to leave with Smith. So Hyatt drives them around for a while, eventually before dropping his friend off at someone else's house around 3:45 a.m., and then he dropped Smith off downtown at the intersection of 6th and Court Street, which was close to those apartments.
Okay.
And the documentary says that that was around 4:15 a.m. So sometime between 3:45 and 4:15 a.m., I guess.
Yeah.
So again, it's brought up that it's an especially cold night and Smith wasn't dressed appropriate for the weather. And so okay. I don't understand, like, Hyatt never tells us, like, why he dropped him off at this random spot. Like, I don't know if he told him he had somewhere to stay or what. Seems weird that you would let your friend who's not dressed appropriately just go wandering out on this freezing cold night.
Right, right. In the middle of the night, especially. And
yeah. And I guess this apartment building, the old Lincoln Electric Company, Smith's grandma used to live in the same apartment building while he was growing up. And I guess they had a very contentious relationship. Smith also had a lengthy criminal record, and by the time he was 15, and he was then sentenced to live in the Youth Development Center in Kearney, Nebraska. And as an adult, he also had burglary and rape charges.
Which sounds like a stand-up guy.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we'll get more into that again as we go on. I know I keep saying that, but
it's just a lot to it. Yeah.
There's so much to this case. So by 1985, he was living primarily with his mom in Oklahoma City, but he traveled back to Beatrice often. Like I said, it was February 5th, 1985, when he came back to town and stopped by Hyatt's. An old high school girlfriend of his also mentioned to police that she saw him at 10:30 a.m. on the morning of February 6th and went driving around town with him and a friend of hers. They both noticed he had scratches on him, and when they asked about it, he stated he'd gotten into a fight with Hyatt the night before. But Hyatt adamantly denies that that never happened. They also found a wallet near the alley of the apartments the morning of the murder that was actually one of the women's from the trailer. And she had reported it missing the night before. So, like, it had been stolen. So whoever stole the wallet dropped it near these apartments.
So it was in the same vicinity. Okay.
Yep. And Smith had told Hyatt that he was tied up for money. Like, Hyatt had bought him beers at the bar and stuff because he was talking about how he was so broke he couldn't even afford a ticket for the bus to go back home.
Okay.
Yeah. So by the time police get all of this information, Smith has left town. So the Beatrice police notify the Oklahoma City police about what's going on and that he might be heading back there. And this is when the Oklahoma City police inform them they've had them on their radar because there was a woman murdered on March 20th of 1984. She was found bound, raped, and strangled.
That sounds interesting.
Yep. Also in 1981, when Smith was 19, he was charged with rape in Oklahoma City, but for some reason he was never prosecuted. Weird. Yeah, I don't know what the fuck is up with that.
Yeah, not okay.
They were just like, oh, it's just, oh, he's 19. Boys will be boys.
It's fine. He made a mistake.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. Typical.
Right. So now, on March 7th of 1985, two investigators from Beatrice head to Oklahoma City to try and track Smith down, to question him and get DNA samples. Eventually, the Oklahoma City police find him at a fast food joint and convince him to come with them. The book says there's no record of the Nebraska police questioning him, but the documentary makes it sound like they did, and he just claimed not to know what they were talking about. Either way, he did agree to give DNA samples. So he gave saliva and hair from his head and pubic hair samples.
Ew.
And yeah. And then after that, the samples were given to the Oklahoma City crime lab tech named Joyce Gilchrist. And that was just a matter of waiting. So at this time in life, DNA is not really a thing, but blood type serology was considered the top scientific method of solving cases. What is this, you ask? Well, let me tell you.
I'm going to. Correct.
So, for those who may not know, there are four blood types. A, B, AB, and O. In addition to this, people are either secretors or non-secretors, which, FYI, over the course of researching this, I found I hate the word secretors.
I hate the word secrete. When you said that, I was, ew, like immediately it just sounds like an icky word.
Yep. So secretes, creators, that's my moist. Creators. Some people don't like moist.
Yeah. I don't mind moist. I don't like secretor either. I don't think. Ew.
So yep. Don't like it. Unfortunately, I'm going to say it a few more times throughout this.
Oh boy. Okay, brace yourself, let me tell everybody.
Yeah. So let me tell you what it means to be a secretor. So this means that your blood type can be determined from your saliva or semen. Now, 85% of people are secretors. It's actually less common to be a non-secretor, and typically they're apparently more prone to illness.
Oh.
So, like I said, Helen's murderer left behind a lot of semen. Samples from the crime scene had already been tested by the Nebraska serologist, Rena Roy. And it was determined that the only two blood types at the scene were type O, which was Helen, and type B, the murderer. Okay. So it was determined that the murderer was type B blood and a secretor. So while they're waiting for the Oklahoma City lab to get back to them on the results, FBI Special Agent Pete Klismet Jr., who was a killer profiler, arrived in Beatrice. So like he was stationed in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Okay. And they interview him in the documentary as well. So he gathers all the reports and evidence, and then he heads back to Cedar Rapids, where he combed over it, worked closely with the FBI Behavioral Science Unit in Quantico, Virginia. And 3.5 months after Helen's murder, he gives them a profile. Says it was most likely a white male in his 20s, short to medium height and skinny, high school dropout, and probably lived at home. Klismet also determined there was only one perp. Only one. Let's remember that. That's going to come in later, too.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So he said the amount of semen could lead one to believe that there was two, but it was more likely that the murderer was comfortable there and stayed for a while and raped her repeatedly post-mortem.
Gross. That is so disturbing.
Yes. He said another thing that made it more likely was the fact that none of the money was taken. He said it was highly unlikely that at least one of them wouldn't have taken the money.
Right. Well, and especially if he's in there for a long time, he had more time to look around and find money if he was like comfortable just waiting there, you know?
Well, and then that would explain having coffee, and I don't know why you wouldn't just use the same coffee cup, but having multiple coffee cups in the same.
Unless he was trying to make it look like, I don't know.
Multiple people, and that could be too.
Right.
So... yeah, so that's what he says. So now the police finally get the results from Oklahoma City, and it's determined that Smith is type B blood, but that he's a non-secretor.
Interesting.
And just like that, they take him off their list of suspects. They Weird. Do take the samples with them, which for a little while are stored in a climate-controlled fridge, but then eventually they end up in the Beatrice Police Department basement along with a bunch of other evidence, and that'll come into play again later.
Okay.
So, okay, I get it. At this point, everyone's probably like, what the fuck does this have to do with anything you mentioned in the beginning, Cassie?
Well, we're going to find out, aren't we?
We're going to find out. I promise it all comes full circle. So the case goes cold. They've interviewed a bunch of people in town. They've even taken DNA samples, but there are just no leads. So there's a farmer named Bert Searcy, who had been a cop for like 5 years with the Beatrice Police Department. And he also knew the Wilson family. So... they hire him as a PI to help solve Helen's murder. But he had actually already, like in the documentary, they mentioned how he had already been working on this case pretty much from the beginning. Like he was bound and determined to solve it. Then a 17-year-old girl named Lisa Poddendorf tells
These Bert, names, wow. I know.
She tells Bert she knows who killed Helen. She said another young girl confessed to her that morning that Helen was found. And what? Bert says he took this to the police, but there's no record of that. Also, why didn't she go to the police if this was true?
Right. Instead of just telling somebody else, like, okay.
Yeah. So shortly after this, Bert actually runs for the Gage County Sheriff. Now, he loses to a man named Jerry DeWitt, but Jerry hires him as a deputy. And then pretty much from the get-go, Bert asks to work on Helen's case. But it's 2 years before Jerry finally gives him the go-ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is where everything starts to go to shit.
Okay.
So it's now 1989. 4 years after Helen's murder, and Bert brings in the now 21-year-old Lisa and tapes her story. So Lisa says that her and her now husband were driving around town, and those of you who grew up in a small town, you know that that's what you do on weekend nights when there's nothing else to do. You just drive around town and bullshit. Some people drink. I mean, you do what you can. Yep. Anyways, so she said that they stopped at this intersection. I don't remember which one, but supposedly from this intersection she was stopped at, she sees Tom Wilson pull into an alley of that apartment. And I'll say this now, but in the documentary, they go to the intersection that Lisa says they were at when they saw Tom Wilson, and it's not there anymore, but in 1985, there was actually a bank on the corner, and it would have completely blocked any view of that alley.
Interesting.
So, already suspect.
Yeah.
So, she also then states that she sees Joanne Taylor and Joseph White in the car. And Joseph is also known as Lobo, and we'll get into how he got that nickname in a little bit, because that's going to be, that story's going to be a little important too. So, she even goes so far as to describe what they're wearing. Which I can barely remember what I wore 2 days ago, and yet she somehow remembers things people were wearing late at night
down the street that she saw them. Yeah. No, hard pass there.
Right. So then she states that the next morning, so February 6th, around 7:30 a.m., she's standing across the street from the apartments, and all the cops are there. And Joanne comes up to her then. But okay, remember Helen wasn't even found by her sister until 9:30. So this doesn't make sense.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So Lisa like then switches her story and says, oh, maybe it was the next morning. But if it's the 7th, you're not going to have that big of a police presence there like you did. If you're saying all the lights are there.
Day. Right.
So anyways, she then says Joanne comes up to her and is acting kind of like hyper, she says, and twitchy, and asks for $500 because she needs to leave town because she and Lobo had killed the woman. But if she needed but the money, she had the she money. Have taken it?
Right. That's what I was just going to say. If she needed it, if that was like the motive, then.
Yeah.
No.
Right. So Joanne supposedly told Lisa that they had tied her up and they'd suffocated her with a pillow. Lisa also mentioned that Joseph used to do this trick with 5s, 10s, and 20s, which she explains. I'm not going to go into it. Essentially, the long story short, how this trick ends is he rips a five, like the money. drops one of it and pockets the other half. But also, I'm going to say, as someone who's worked in banking, and maybe this was different in the 80s, but you have to have more than half of a ripped bill in order for a bank to take it.
Right.
Because otherwise, everyone would rip bills in half and double their and money.
Split them. Yeah, like, duh. Okay, no.
So why would you be ripping up money and just leaving half lie around? I don't know.
It'd and especially when you're that desperate to have money too. It sounds like they're not like they were made of money by any means. So that's nope.
Yeah. So at this point, while Bert is going on about his business trying to solve this case, Tom Winslow is actually in jail in Lincoln for burglary and assault. And I think he was like beating someone up. And he was hoping to get a bond he could afford so he could get out on bail. And so actually in 1985, the police had spoken to Tom and they'd even taken a blood sample from him and it was found not to be a match.
That's interesting.
So Tom had spoken to Bert in 1985 and told him he'd been at work. Then in 1989, he said he'd actually lent his car to Joseph and Joanne, but that he hadn't been with them. So Bert ends up offering Tom a deal. If he has information on Helen Wilson, Bert will make it so the charges are reduced and he gets a bond he can afford so he can get out. Mm-hmm. Which I already don't like when they try to make deals with like
inmates. You're already compromising. Like, yeah.
Right. Because what do they have to lose by lying?
Right. No, exactly. And that's the thing. And it's like, why even make a deal just to get something less? I mean, just to put them away, like just no. And especially if you do have enough to hold them, why would you even want to give them that? No.
Yeah. I don't understand that. So we're going to find Bert is a little shady. So Tom, now Tom had been there and he confirmed Lisa's story. But when Bert went to go record his testimony with Tom, Tom can't really give him any details and he's very vague. So Bert's like, oh, you must be having a hard time. Let's take a break. And they turn off the camera for 44 minutes. That's not suspicious at all.
No. Okay, so, whatever.
Yeah. So now when it's turned back on, Tom now knows they went upstairs. You know, he has more information. And even though the apartment was broken into, he says they knocked and there was an argument during which Helen went for the phone. And so Joseph pushed her toward the bedroom and Joanne followed. Tom said he heard Helen scream. And so he went back down to the car. Tom told Bert that Joanne and Joseph admitted once to him that they killed Helen, and that was apparently enough to go arrest them.
Oh.
So Joseph now is already back. He's back in Alabama. Like, he had lived there for a while. I don't know how he ended up in Beatrice, like if he had lived in Beatrice before. Anyways, he's in Alabama right now. He was the second of six kids, and he had spent some time in the army. And after that, he went to Hollywood for a bit to try and become a movie star.
Okay.
That didn't happen, but this is how he got the nickname Lobo. And the long story short is that he did some gay porn.
Oh, okay.
And based on his title in the movie, it was then like shortened to Lobo. And I don't care that he did gay porn. Like, cool. He probably, I mean, let's face it, he probably made more money as a male actor in gay porn than he would have in like heterosexual porn.
I was gonna say, well, hey, at least he did something to in Hollywood, I guess. Acting I was thinking of, a movie star, but you know,
whatever, to each their own. So but that's gonna be important later, that he did gay porn. That's how he got the nickname Lobo. And because otherwise I wouldn't bring it up, because who cares?
Yeah, right.
So then in 1984 he moved back to Beatrice with Joanne, because he was going to try to help her with getting custody of her child. Like, she had lost custody of a child. So in the documentary, Joseph's mom was interviewed, and she said he was always trying to help women. Like, he was a sucker for a woman in distress. And like, even as a young man, he'd help older women cross the street or with their groceries. It sounds like she's like, there's no way he would have ever harmed a woman. So 2 weeks after Helen's murder, he had moved back to Alabama to his mom's because he was struggling to find work. And so in between then and March 1989, when Bert comes to arrest him, he has a job, he has a house and a girlfriend. So they arrested him at midnight and they told him it was for Helen's rape and murder. But he was always adamant that he was innocent. Like, he never, of the six people who are eventually convicted for Helen's murder, he always maintained his innocence. So from Alabama, Bert then heads to North Carolina to arrest Joanne. And in the documentary, they interview Jeff Peterson, who's eventually a lawyer for all six of them. So the information I got is from what he said. Joanne had a rough childhood. She grew up neglected and abused, and she had borderline personality disorder. And borderline personality disorder is a mental health disorder that impacts the way you think and feel about yourself and others, causing problems functioning in everyday life. It induces self-image issues, difficulty managing emotions and behavior, and a pattern of unstable relationships. And I got that definition from the Mayo Clinic, because you know I was going to give you the definition of that.
Yeah, I knew I didn't have to ask, so we're good there. So this is number three. This is the third person that's getting arrested. Is this what we're
at? Tom was talked to. He wasn't arrested.
Okay,
he's out on bond now. He got, you know, this bargain of you give us information and we'll get you a bond. So he's like, it was all, I was there, but I was in the car.
Gotcha. Okay.
So Peterson says that he has no doubt that Joanne had a horrible childhood, but he said it's hard to know what's true and what isn't because her mental illness is rather severe and she was pretty delusional. And so I'm not going to get too much into that. Like, at points, right, I guess when she was being talked to by the police, she mentioned that she thought she was psychic and that she knew others who were too, and different things that should, as a law enforcement officer, make you question her mental competency. So after Joanne's arrested, Bert then does a taped interview with her. In it, she clearly is disoriented and confused. So she tells Bert that she was with Joseph and another boy, but she doesn't remember what his name was. So then she said they went to a light-colored one-story house, and Joseph was going to go do yard work. Never mind that it's late at night in February, the coldest night apparently ever. You know, and that it was an apartment building, not a house.
Right.
So she then says she saw Joseph beat the woman, and then he and the other boy raped the woman. And at this point, Bert's like, you realize you're just putting yourself there, and this is a serious offense. And Joanne replied, yes, because I was told I was there. The police who picked me up told me I was there. Joanne also has no memory of talking to Lisa at all. So, and
clearly she's not all there. You're on drugs or,
So in a move that should surprise no one, Bert asks if she wants to take a break, and they stop the tape for 19 minutes. And when they come back, Joanne's memory has all of a sudden miraculously improved. Now she might have talked to Lisa. She remembers it was an apartment. And oh yeah, Joseph likes to tear up money for fun. I don't
know. That's so weird. No, no.
Yeah.
Bert, I'm already now, I'm like, Bert, did you do this?
Yeah. So as soon as she's brought back to Nebraska, Joanne is interviewed by Wayne Price. Now, he's a local psychologist, but also he's a reserve deputy with the sheriff's office. Also, he already knew and had a professional relationship with Joanne because he was the psychologist who treated her while she was in the process of getting her parental rights taken away.
Oh.
So that tells us that he should know about her BPD and how severe it is. That's why she lost, like, that's the whole reason why she lost custody of her child, is because of how severe her BPD was. Oh my goodness, that's hard to say.
Yeah, that's harder to say than just saying it.
Yep, it is. So now he's interviewing her for a quote-unquote competency eval to say she was of sound mind at the time of her taped interview. Never mind that he wasn't there for the interview and hadn't watched the video or read the transcripts from it. So this seems to me like a huge breach of conduct as a psychologist.
Yeah.
And I did talk to my sister about it. She said it definitely falls under the dual relationship, which is very much frowned upon. It's kind of an ethical gray area for counselors and psychologists. So don't worry, I'll give you that definition too. Dual relationships, also known as multiple relationships, refer to a situation in which multiple roles exist between a therapist and a client. For example, when a client is also a friend or family member, it is considered a dual relationship. And I got this from the website aasect.org. And it says the reason for this and dual relationship, a therapist, a reason why it might cause issues is because a therapist might misuse their power and influence or exploit a client to their favor. Now, there isn't a law against it. It's just generally a code of ethics thing. And there are acknowledgments that sometimes it's gray areas and or times where it's unavoidable. But this isn't one of those times.
Right. This
is definitely a horrible time. So at this point, Tom, like I said, he's out on bond, but they bring him in for a lineup and Joanne picks him out as the other boy. So he's arrested again and now charged with murder. So, I mean, to me, it seems like Joanne, when she was back in Beatrice, probably did hang out with Tom, probably knew him, and so she just recognized him, you know?
Right. That's why she picked him out, yeah.
Yep. So he has to speak with Bert again, and he changes his story again. Tom is saying he was, in fact, in the apartment, but Joseph and Joanne... Okay, but yeah, so now he's saying he was in the apartment. But the problem here is that Tom, Joseph, and Joanne didn't have the right blood type. Because remember, they're looking for blood type B.
B secretion.
And a non-secretor.
Or non-secretor is what they want.
No, a secretor. They need a secretor. Okay. I typed that wrong in my notes. They're looking for a secretor.
Okay.
So type B secretor.
Okay.
So pretty much at this point, they're just interviewing anyone who had contact with these three people. And this leads them to a man that Tom had spent time with in jail. This man...
Of course.
I didn't ever get this man's name. But he tells them he knows all about the murder, and in fact, his very own wife may have been part of it. Yeah. He brats out his wife.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Clearly not a ride-or-die type of husband.
Yeah, dang. You don't have to. Okay.
Yeah. So this is how the fourth of our six gets brought in. So the man's wife was named Deborah Sheldon, and she was actually a distant relative of Helen Wilson. Doesn't say how, it just said she was. And Deborah suffered from mental illness as well. Although, again, I didn't really say what. But it also said she had a low intellectual function.
But okay, again, so she's easy to pin it on, if anything.
And so Jeff Peterson, remember the lawyer they're interviewing in the documentary, he said she was absolutely one of the sweetest women he's ever met. So after hours of interrogation, Deborah says that she was there with the other three, that Joanne and Joseph had demanded money. Again, no money was taken. That Tom and Joseph raped her, and that Joanne held a pillow over her face while the men did this. So then Wayne Price interviewed Deborah too. And at this point, in a move that should be surprising to no one, Wayne Price had a prior relationship with her, like a doctor-patient relationship with her as well. So Price, he believes in something called repressed memories. This is the idea that the brain takes traumatic memories and blocks them, but that they could come back in flashes or dreams. I guess this was a popular theory in the 80s and early 90s, but it's been largely debunked now. So he has Deborah lay back and tells her to relax and it will come to her. So eventually she comes up with the name James Dean, not the movie star.
James Dean's dead by then.
Yep.
Okay.
But it was a guy who she'd hung out with in Beatrice in 1985. And James was in his early 20s at the time. So in 1989, he's living in Lincoln with two kids, and he was actually arrested on his 25th birthday. And he's actually interviewed in the documentary, and he talks about how Bert made him get on the ground in this gravel parking lot, and that Bert actually pushed his face into the gravel with his foot. Jeez. Yeah. And that it took 45 minutes for the police to tell him that he was being arrested for Helen's murder. So James insisted he had nothing to do with it. After a few days, Wayne Price came to him as well, failing to mention that he's actually a deputy and just mentions that he's a psychologist.
Yeah.
And
I can see where this is going.
In these few days, while James is sitting here before Price comes to talk to him, they've been showing James pictures and videos of the crime scene. Yeah. You guys can't see Shannon's face.
Yeah, but it's my face is
disgust and shock.
Yeah, it is. Just so you all know. Wow.
Yeah, seems
that's like wrong on all the levels. So yeah, now it's familiar to him because he's seen it now.
Well, so now Wayne comes to him and brings up the whole repressed memory thing, and at this point, James is starting to wonder if maybe that's not the case. Like, he dreamt of the murders. I don't know. Maybe because they just showed him a bunch of shit about it.
Yeah, and that's a traumatizing thing to see.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So James then asks to take a lie detector test, and they tell him he failed it miserably, which I don't know if he actually did or if they just lied to him, because hey guys, cops don't have to tell you the truth.
And also lie detector tests are so stupid. Thank you.
Right. I was about to that's exactly
so inaccurate.
It. Yeah. They are not even admissible in court.
No. That's just insane.
So now this poor guy thinks, maybe I was there. So he pleads guilty to a lesser amended charge of aiding abetting second-degree murder.
Oh my gosh.
But we have, what, five people? And none of them are type B blood.
Yet they were so quick to dismiss the first guy who had the same type of blood minus the whole secretion.
You just wait. Because you're going to wonder again why they dismissed him so much. So, to recap, we have Joseph, Joanne, Tom, Deborah, and James, all in jail for the rape and murder of Helen, and yet none of them have type B blood.
Oops. As I'm looking pictures of them up, and you cannot see on there, but I'm just like, it's interesting to see them as we go, and I'm like, okay.
Yep. Let's also remember that the FBI profiler, who I'm not saying is infallible, but probably has more knowledge on this stuff than a local sheriff department, especially a deputy who was a farmer.
Yeah.
He said there was only one, but now we have five. So, Bert still needs someone with type B blood. And eventually James and Deborah bring up the name Kathy Gonzalez.
Oh gosh. Now another, there's a lot of women involved. I didn't realize that too in this.
Yep. So she,
which, wait, Oh, go ahead. No, I was going to say they obviously cannot.
You hold that thought.
I provide know where you're sperm, going. But okay, go ahead.
Oh, I've got that in my notes. You just wait.
Same wavelength.
Yeah. So Kathy had known Joseph, and she'd actually let him stay with her for a few days while he was in town, you know, trying to help Joanne. Couldn't find a job. Incidentally, her apartment was the one right above Helen's.
Okay.
And Kathy had type B blood. So, yeah, I guess we're just completely ignoring that blood was taken from the semen left at the scene. Because, yeah, that apparently doesn't matter anymore. Oh, she was also a secretor. Again, they didn't say a shit ton of saliva was left at the scene.
Interesting. And so did she leave any sperm from her
apparently we female
parts? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she is biologically female.
Correct.
So yeah, I guess because of that, you know, and if we're no longer caring about the fact that it came from semen, then why are we caring that it was a secretor or a non-secretor?
Right.
Because Bruce Smith has all of the circumstantial evidence stacked against him. And just a reminder, circumstantial evidence just means that no one actually saw it with their own eyes, but it's evidence that can lead you to a natural conclusion.
Yes.
Common sense. He had semen. Kind of about
that. Oh, right.
So Bruce Smith, at least, was able to provide semen and type B blood. So apparently being a secretor is more important than, you know, being able to leave semen.
Right. And all the other things about his testimony, I mean, you know, what he told his friend and okay, that's just
so yeah,
it's bananas.
Bananas. So Price then visits Kathy as well to help her supposedly remember. They also offer her a plea deal of 10 years prison time. So the lawyer Jeff Peterson, he remarks in the documentary that Kathy made a business decision. She could take the deal and be out in 5 years on good behavior, or she could take her chances in court with a jury and potentially be given death for something she didn't do. So she pleads no contest to aiding and abetting second-degree murder, which, what a shit.
That is shit. That is, I hate when someone, you know, when you're innocent, like, you're basically like, okay, so you could possibly die or just spend time in prison regardless. Like, I'll take my chances. Thanks. Gosh.
I don't know, though, because you have to think about it, because they even mentioned in the documentary how all these people were, like, quote unquote, disposable to these people in this society. And
well, if they were that quick to throw them into prison or jail for something without that much evidence, I mean, I guess in this specific case, nah. I mean, nowadays, I would never. Yeah.
I mean, nowadays things, we have DNA and stuff to help. There's, I mean, that's not to say that shit doesn't still happen. That's today.
So true. And these people, I feel like we're taken advantage of too, because of like in their mental capacity of, you know, it reminds me all over again of Making a Murderer with the Stephen Avery, with the nephew, Brendan Dassey.
Yes. Yeah. And we'll kind of talk a little bit more about like false confessions and how these things come out a little later on, because they actually interviewed a specialist on that too. So, you know, at this point, Tom and Joseph both denied having anything to do with Helen's murder, so they were both set to go to trial. So Joseph White goes to trial first, and remember, this is like 1989 or 1990 at this point. Nebraska is already still a conservative state, even in 2022, but then even more so. So the prosecution, so the prosecution brings up the fact that he'd been in gay porn to paint him in a bad light.
And what, like, which guy was this?
Joseph White. So
Lobo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Joseph White. Okay.
Yes. So, you know, they're talking about how he's like a sexual deviant and shit.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
It's and porn, first of all, and then gay porn on top of it. It's like two strikes against him. So.
Yes. And that's why I brought it up. You know, like I said, I don't care. You do you. You make that money. If it's legal.
Well, yeah, but in the 80s, too, that was like a way different thing. Yeah.
Exactly. So they also interviewed a journalist in this documentary who said when Joseph took the stand in his own defense, he didn't really do himself any favors. And I guess according to, you know, the lawyer they were interviewing, he said he's just a really matter-of-fact, straightforward speaking type of person. Mm-hmm. So the prosecution shows him a picture of Helen and asks him, who is this? And he just says, an old woman. He didn't know Helen. So yeah, but apparently everyone just thought this was atrocious that he said that. I think he was damned if you do and damned if you don't in this instance. Right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't know. But Deborah, Joanne, and James, and I don't know about Kathy, maybe her too, they all testified against Joseph as part of their plea deals.
Jeez.
And James actually said that Joseph had threatened him. So, yeah, Joseph's defense tried to cast doubt on the witnesses, pointing out that they were unreliable witnesses, that Joanne had severe borderline personality disorder.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, after just 4 hours of deliberation, the jury found Joseph guilty of first-degree murder, and he was then sentenced to life in prison.
Damn.
So after this, Tom was like, yeah, I'm not gonna take my chances with the trial. So he pleaded no contest to second-degree murder and ended up with 50 years in prison.
Jeez.
So they gave him a deal. Joanne got 10 to 40 years in prison, and Deb, Kathy, and James all got 10 years.
Jeez.
So
that's Joseph, a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, even especially for something you didn't do, if you didn't do it.
Right. So Joseph continued to insist on his innocence, and he truly believed that the truth would come out. And after 15 years in prison, he wrote a letter to a lawyer named Doug Stratton asking mm-hmm. him to become his lawyer. So Doug goes to meet with Joseph, and afterwards he told his wife that he truly did believe him. So he became his lawyer, and Doug found it odd that Tom never took the stand against Joseph because he was going to have his own trial until after, you know, he saw what happened with Joseph.
Uh-huh.
So Doug's like, I'm going to go talk to Tom and see what's up. And Tom breaks down and he tells him, he's like, I was never there, but no one would believe me. So Doug asked Joseph, Doug asked Joseph if anyone had ever suggested he use the DNA statute that was passed in 2001. Joseph tells him no, and this statute gives imprisoned felons the right to test DNA that was never tested before but was involved in their case. So this is where we come back to the fact that the DNA from the crime scene had ended up in a box in the basement in the Beatrice Police Department. Miraculously, it was still in great condition and could be tested.
Wow, I'm surprised.
Yeah. So they send it off. And 8 months later, it came back that none of the DNA matches either Tom or Joseph. The Nebraska Attorney General at the time, John Bruning, he hears about this and he creates a task force to look at the case with fresh eyes. He wants them to look at it as if it's a brand new case. However, he's not doing this to prove their innocence. He's doing it to try and prove that they're guilty. In fact, they were so confident these people were guilty that they told Helen's family not to worry. They have the right people and they're not going to get out.
Wow.
So they sent off more than 40 DNA samples and none of it matches any of the six. It's just Helen and this unknown male. So all six of the convicted are excluded because of the DNA. Lisa's story was also proved false. Like I said before, based on the intersection she said she was at when she saw Tom, you know, Tom, Joanne, yeah. and Joseph, there yeah. would have been a bank blocking her view. Yeah. She also stated she saw Joanne at 7:30 in the morning. Helen's body was discovered, but Helen wasn't found till 9:30, you know. And Lisa never said why she told Bert this story. It's either Bert or Bruce. I have Bert and Bruce in my notes now. So now I'm confusing myself.
Same thing, you know, Bert,
Cersei,
Bruce.
The farmer. Farmer Cersei.
Yeah, there you go.
So I don't get how she didn't get into legal trouble for it.
Right. And that's a crime in itself.
Right. And I'm kind of surprised that the six didn't sue her.
I know.
For defamation or something, you know?
Yeah.
So at this point.
They probably could have.
Right. So at this point, it's 2008. 2008. Okay. Three of the six had already served their time. The only ones left in prison were Joseph, Tom, and Joanne. So the first three. And they had all spent nearly 20 years in prison when they were finally released.
Wow.
So now we're probably like, okay, so who was it? Do we actually know? Yes. Yes, we actually do. And guess what? It was
Drum
Bruce
roll.
Smith. It was Bruce Smith the whole time. His DNA was also saved and retested, which I don't get why the Nebraska lab, I don't get why the Nebraska lab didn't retest it themselves.
Are you from Beatrice? Okay. Just kidding. They don't talk like that, probably.
No.
Okay.
I don't know. Anyways, I don't know why they didn't retest it then, but they didn't. So turns out the Oklahoma City lab messed up. In fact, they messed up a few times. So he was, in fact, a type B secretor.
Secretor. Wow.
Uh-huh. Unfortunately, he died in 1992 of AIDS. So wow.
He that got is away with insane. It. So he sure did.
Uh-huh.
Wow. But, that's insane, though. That they,
yeah.
If they pulled it out and retested it against all the people that had been charged or whatever and were in serving time, why would they not have retested that? That doesn't even make any sense.
I know.
I feel like so many people dropped the ball here.
Oh, 100%. Actually, so this Bruce Smith's DNA, his was actually one of several cases whose DNA were mishandled by Gilchrist. Remember we mentioned Joyce Girl, who was in charge of the lab at the time? Four cases were overturned because of her mishandling.
Dang. So she
was, yeah, she was fired in 2001. But
well, like, yeah.
No charges were filed against her, which I
not
don't
for negligence or like anything. That's insane.
I guess not.
So she just ruined a million people's lives, but it's okay. It's fine.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep. So on November 7th of 2008, the Attorney General publicly announced that the Beatrice Six were not involved at all in the rape and murder of Helen Wilson. They were also actually the first six people in the state of Nebraska to be exonerated by DNA. Wow. Joseph actually got his charges dismissed while all the others got pardons. I don't know why they weren't all dismissed. Like,
right.
I don't get that, but whatever. James actually apologized to Joseph when they finally saw each other for the first time. And I guess Joseph forgave him on the spot. And so all of them regarded Joseph as a hero because if it wasn't for him, they wouldn't be out. He was the one who was continually pushing. And Joseph also led the civil lawsuit against Gage County. So like the state awarded them a $2 million settlement, which I think was split between the six of them from the state of Nebraska. But they also had a civil lawsuit against Gage County, Searcy, Sheriff DeWitt, and Wayne Price.
Good.
So some more bummer news. In 2011, Joseph White was back in Alabama. He was engaged and working at a local coal factory when he was sadly killed by a piece of machinery. He was trying to fix it and it fell on him.
Sad. So like 3 years, barely 3 years after he got...
After he got out, yes. Despite his death, though, the other five and Joseph's family continued on with the civil lawsuit, which they eventually won. By this time, Sheriff DeWitt had passed, but his state, you know, had been involved. But he ended up not being found liable. I don't know. I think that's a little...
That's BS.
He was in charge. He was letting it go. However, Gage County and the other two men were. But because Searcy and... Price worked for the county, like they're not actually liable for the money. Like it's all the county responsible, which I think is BS. I think it should be the county and them.
Yeah.
So they won and they were awarded $28.1 million.
Total, like between all of them, I'm assuming, and then the split.
Yeah. Wow. So they all get split. So of course that means since Gage County's liable for it, property taxes have gone up.
Yeah, so and everyone else pays for it for their mistake. That sucks.
Yep. And believe it or not, despite the DNA evidence exonerating all of them and proving Bruce Smith was the killer, there are still those in town who believe the six are guilty.
Seriously?
Uh-huh. Including including Helen Wilson's family, which for them at least I can kind of understand. You know, they had spent so many years believing this, and I mean,
that's just hard to never get that kind of closure. It's like just they can't even just deal with it and move on because it's
we know who the killer is. And so they were interviewing one of her grandsons in this documentary, and he talks about how the only person of the six they have any sympathy for was Joseph White because he always maintained his innocence. But he's like, I guess her family thinks that the other five were part of it with Bruce. Because they admitted to stuff.
Yeah, but that's sad because, I mean, I don't know.
Because of the emotional trauma they've already been through, like, I cut them some slack. Other people, I'm like, no. The other people in town, I'm like, come on. Right. I'm not going to, you know, say anything one way or the other about her family. They've been through so much already.
Yeah.
Like, I can't even begin to imagine what that's like. Right. But so talking about, like, kind of getting back to false confessions.
Yeah.
So they interviewed Dr. Richard Leo, who's a false testimony expert, and he was actually a key witness in the civil suit case, too. Yeah. And he said that while many would like to believe they would never falsely admit to something they did not do, he's like, many people's mental fortitude is actually not that strong, because they use kind of, I don't want to say torture tactics, but like lack of sleep. And they, you know, they had lack of sleep, not to mention the fact that they're threatening them with the death penalty.
Yeah.
And I think at this point in the 80s and stuff, but we saw the electric chair, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was, yeah.
And then, you know, he talked about how those with mental illness and lower IQs are at a higher risk. But yeah, he just said being threatened with death penalty, being sleep deprived, not to mention being fed information and shown pictures, like, it's not unusual for them to have confessed. Yeah. Like, it makes sense.
And
it,
you hear about it all the time, unfortunately. Yeah. Like, I mean, plenty of movies, but like, not even that, but like documentaries and stuff that you watch, you just hear about it. And it's like, I think it's easy to say, like, oh my gosh, why would you say that you did something you didn't do? But you have to put yourself in that situation and think, well, when you haven't slept for 12 hours and you're in a room and they're telling you you did do it over and over and over, you start to think, did I do it? Right. You know, because they're,
especially if they've been feeding you stuff, you're sleep deprived. Yes. I mean, and not to mention, okay, like, look at like Kathy, you know, like, okay, so she made that choice of like, I could potentially be put to death or I can serve 5 years. Like, I'd rather serve the 5 years and be done.
Yeah.
You know, and
like,
so,
they already think I did this. So who's to say, that a jury, right,
especially if she realizes that like, she's not gonna be like, she's disposable. Like, they were all like, we were the people that people would be fine disposing of.
Totally.
So, you know, I just kind of want to talk a little bit about where these six are now. Joanne actually works as an advocate, and the book has a quote from her stating that she had her associate's degree and was working on her bachelor's, and her major at the time was psychology. It's really hard to find information, but Tom has kept a low profile, and the book mentions that the book mentions where he lived, but I saw an article stating that he keeps a low profile, so I'm not going to mention it.
Yeah.
But the book also mentioned that in 2015, he made a rare appearance for the Innocent Project conference in Orlando, Florida. But Tom's actually the one who was the cousin of the person I know.
Oh, okay.
And so his cousin told me that he's happily married now, working as his CNA, and he like recently had a trip to Hawaii and stuff. So
good for him.
You know, yeah. The book doesn't mention anything about Deborah, Kathy, or James.
Hmm.
Don't know why. And at the time the book was written, they hadn't won the lawsuit yet or anything like that. But I found an article from the Cinemaholic that mentioned that Deborah moved to Lincoln with her husband after her release. And I don't know if this is the same one who ratted her out.
Right.
I don't know. But it says not much is known about her whereabouts after that. And like I said, James was actually interviewed in the documentary, but other than seeing him in that, he appears to have stayed out of the public eye. And the only thing I found about Kathy was that she moved to York, Nebraska. And at one point before they, you know, had won the settlement, she was working as a grocery cashier. So
that's just so crazy.
You know, with that, I'm going to, when I post pictures this week, it's only going to be of Helen and the six, the most recent pictures I found on them there. I just feel like this week, they were all victims.
That's so sad.
And that's, I think, who I just want to highlight this week, but that's the Beatrice Six. And unfortunately, Helen Wilson's murder.
I can't believe, we don't hear more about that, because that's a huge thing. Like, I don't know how a movie hasn't been made about, like, you know what I mean? A lot, because that's like a huge, huge mess up. Six people. It's bad enough when it's one person, like, but six people. And there's so many things that could have been prevented had someone else stepped in. I feel like it's sometimes all about who's in charge and who you know.
Well, and like in the documentary one, it talks about how like there was this really big rivalry between the sheriff's department and the Beatrice police department. And honestly, I think Bert, he to me, it does. I get that Helen Wilson's family loves him. They think he's great. To me, it feels more like Bert cared more about getting
a conviction,
praise, like, for, oh, yeah. Like, I think he just wanted to solve it and be praised for, I think in the end, I think in the beginning, he maybe started with good intentions, but then I think he just wanted it to work out for him.
Yeah.
Like, they interviewed the old attorney general, whose name I can't remember, but I'm like, you're kind of a douche for trying to prove these people wrong.
Right.
Still, but he's like, I don't think he had malicious intent. I'm like, bullshit. Like, he clearly did some shady shit to get his, it to way, turn out his way.
It's just like the case we talked about a few weeks ago where the CSI director, Stephen Kofod, yeah, that guy, he was in Omaha, how he had planted evidence too. And it's like, I think he just wanted that conviction because he wanted to say, we solved this, it's done. And I think sometimes it's sad when it gets to that point where they just want to have a case closed instead of having it closed the right way, or like the right person. As long as someone's put away, they can say that justice was served and they did their job.
Exactly. If he would have gone back and been like, hey, let's retest Bruce Smith's, you know, DNA, cool, you're a hero now, dude, because he could have actually been arrested and at least served some time before he died.
I know. What a piece. Like, he just got away with it, and he knew he got away with it. You know, that's even worse. Oh, I know. God. And
so I did try to find, too, if the other woman from Oklahoma City, if that was ever solved and if he was tied to it. But I couldn't even find for sure who that victim was. I found one thing, but it didn't seem right. So I had kind of hoped that I could find her and figure that out. I couldn't. Maybe some of you out there can. Because I just felt like March 20th, 1984, I tried to search that in Oklahoma City. Some other stuff found up. It didn't really sound like it was hers. One of them, it was, it said, and maybe it was, this one I found said something about that, but it mentioned her being a mother, and I think it said she was in her 30s, and I think this other one was in her 20s, and it was like the husband or the ex-husband or something. So okay, so I don't know if they were the same and there was just some miscommunication in there, or if it was just a weird coincidence that this had happened the year prior and was similar to what Bruce did, but it was someone else. I don't really know. All around, it's just a really sad case. I'm glad that five of the six are able to live their life. It's so sad that Joseph,
I know, the one that really fought for them too, like, that sucks.
Yeah, and like I said, that's why they were interviewing his mom in the documentary. And I'm glad they still had that, you know. And it sounds like he was genuinely a caring guy. He held no resentments, it doesn't sound like, against any of the others who named him. And I mean, like I said, a lot of victims in this. Helen, the six, Helen's family. Like,
I know. I see what you mean, how it does get easily forgot, the original crime and that victim, you know, because you just, it's so easy to focus on this crazy insanity that happened. And so you kind of, you don't forget, but there's a lot of crimes, and
there's so much to this case that, it's easy for Helen to kind of just get kind of forgotten, lost in the background of it all, because there is so much to this. Like I said, it's just a very heartbreaking case. This one's a bit heavier, I know, but pretty much I knew I wanted to do this case since before we did, like, before we'd actually even decided to do this podcast. I knew when we were serious about doing this podcast, I wanted to do this one. I've been trying to, like, kind of research it since the beginning a little bit, because I wanted to make sure I did it justice. And obviously there's so many, like, the book has so many details to it. I tried to listen to the audiobook of it first. I just couldn't handle the narrator personally.
That can be, make or break it a lot of times. Yeah,
some people might be great. You know, they're good with it. It was just, I mean, the book's interesting. It's massive. It, like I said, gives tons of details. The documentary was done really well, I felt like.
I'll have to watch that.
Yeah. Like I said, that was on Discovery Plus. Cool. I don't know if you have to have a login to watch it or not. I have my mom's login.
So yeah, what I did, because I think from last week that I did, I watched one on there too. And I did, well, it's like a week trial, and then I forgot to cancel it, which, whatever. And so then I got charged, like, it's like $5. I think it was $4.99. That's what it is. If you actually have to get a subscription, which I'm like, that's totally worth it. I feel like to watch all the things. So I just renewed for a month, you know, so now I'm definitely watching that.
Was that Paramount? I can't remember.
That, which one? The one last week?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, that, it was Discovery last week, but I think a couple weeks ago, it was Paramount. Discovery
last week. Okay. Yeah. Listen.
See, they start to run together.
They do. And between, like, my mom and my sister and me, like, we share all the things.
Oh, yeah.
So totally. I've got all the watching options, fortunately.
Yeah. Same. Mostly. And,
well, yeah, I mean, I don't have I have HBO Max, but I don't have the Showtimes and stuff.
I did end up canceling my Showtime after I finished what I was watching.
I did because I was watch
like,
it.
I know, it's okay. You can do a free trial still, but I was like, I just can't justify spending that much more. I watched all the shows I wanted on it. Like Yellow Jackets is also on Showtime. Good one. If you guys like to check out a weird thriller. But yeah, that's a whole nother topic. So enough of that, I suppose. No, sorry.
I need to watch that and I need to watch the new Dexter. So I just need to find a time where I know I can binge it. Cause it's like a week. You get a week, right?
Yeah. Oh, no, wait. I think it's a month. I think I got a month because after I watched it, I gave it to you and it was still like a couple weeks. And then I was like, well,
I was the worst and I didn't utilize it at the time.
It's okay. We have several email addresses to utilize.
It'll be fine. Anyways. Yeah. So that's this week. Just a reminder, you guys, please rate and review wherever you can. It really does help us.
Yes, it does. Please
appreciate it so much.
We do.
Everything will be linked in show notes, you know, Instagram, Facebook. Our email is heartland.darklandpodcast@gmail.com. But until next time, stay heartland kind.
But darkland wary.